The first thing I notice is that he's not wearing that atrocious hat. He looks different without it. He has quite lovely hair, thick and black and swept, with the slightest curl to it. I study it admiringly before noticing the rest of his clothes are different too. Instead of the jeans and shirt, he's wearing a business suit with a tie. There's something else quite different about him too, something to do with his face. I can't quite put my finger on it. "I'm so sorry to do this, Fern," he says, "but something has come up and I won't be able to watch Alfie for a couple of hours. I could have left him at your place, but I knew you'd worry, so I brought him here. It's an interview of sorts. It just came up and I...
For someone who is usually so eloquent, Wally seems to be struggling to string a sentence together. It's almost as if he's nervous. I look him up and down again, the suit, the tie. Suddenly I realize what is different about his face. "You shaved." He rubs his face and smiles at the floor.
"I did."
"For the meeting?"
"Yes. It's with a former colleague of mine. We worked together a few years back, and there's a chance we could do something together again."
He holds out Alfie's lead, and I'm grabbing hold of it when I hear Carmel's cart rolling toward me.
"Fern, there you are."
"Who's that?" Wally asks.
I gauge the distance between Carmel and me and deduce that it's too late to make a run for it. "My manager. She wants me to go 10-pin bowling. I have a company-sponsored bowling night on Wednesday."
"Really?" Wally says. "Funny, because I'm an excellent 10-pin bowler."
"Would you like to be my guest?"
"Sure," Wally says. "Why not?"
Carmel rolls to a stop in front of us, staring at Alfie. "Put me down for two for the bowling, Carmel," I say. Carmel glances up from Alfie.
"Pardon?"
"Two for the bowling, me and Wally."
"Rocco,"
Wally corrects, shooting me a frown. He extends his hand to Carmel.
"Rocco Ryan."
I think Carmel is going to protest, but instead she takes his hand.
"Rocco Ryan?"
She stares at Wally for a moment, then shakes her head.
Fine. I'll put you both down. But Fern, the dog has got to go."
I pretend not to hear her. "Good luck with the meeting," I say to Wally. Carmel and I both watch Wally walk away. He looks nice in his suit. I get the feeling from Carmel's odd behavior that she has noticed too.
"I'll look forward to bowling,"
I call after him on a whim, realizing, despite the multitude of reasons I shouldn't, that it's true. I have a secret at the library that no one knows about, not even Gail. I found out about it several years ago while Janet was still the manager. I'd been at the front desk that day because Linda and Gail had both been off work with a hacking cough that had done the rounds of the library staff, which I'd escaped due to my disinclination to shake hands. A council meeting had taken place in the circular meeting room that afternoon, and afterward, tea and cakes had been served. I hated it when tea and cakes were served to the council workers because it meant dozens of fat, balding, middle-aged men were hanging around, nursing cups of tea and pieces of cake and taking up lots of space, physical and emotional, the way fat, balding, middle-aged men did. Their small talk hummed around the building, bouncing off walls and making me feel squidgy. Lots of questions like, "Excuse me, love, where's the bathroom? And you couldn't clear this plate away, could you, doll?" I'd give them blank stares and scurry away, but wherever I went, there were more fat old men with more questions. Worse, this time, one of them had located the little bell at the front desk that I had hidden in a drawer and was pinging it every few seconds. Ping.
"Excuse me."
Ping.
"Is anyone here?"
Ping, ping, ping. It was hard to describe what that particular kind of noise, trapped noise, did to me. It filled my brain like a scream, until tears itched at my eyes and my heart threatened to burst from my chest. I'd been hiding among the travel books at the back of the building when Janet, my old boss, found me. "Bad place to hide," she whispered. "These guys all fancy themselves as world travellers. They'll be back here soon, looking for books about Egypt so they can point out all the places they went on their last vacation."
"Crochet section?" I asked.
"I've got a better idea," Janet said.
"Follow me."
I followed her to the very back of the library, the older part beyond the archive area. There, in the red brick wall, was a door that I had not noticed before. Janet opened it with a key. "This is a little treasure I found a few years back," she said, opening the door to a tiny windowless room filled entirely by a shabby armchair and a small side table. It had a slanting roof where the stairs went overhead. "I call it the secret cupboard. I use it sometimes to make phone calls or go through payroll or do something where I don't want to be interrupted, but I think perhaps you could use it more than me." She handed me the key. "This is the only key that I know of. It's yours now." I looked at the small gold key. "Use it whenever you like, but don't ever tell anyone of its existence. It's too precious to be shared." I agreed. Far too precious. I had been in the secret cupboard earlier this year when Janet had a massive stroke in junior nonfiction. Dead before she hit the ground, apparently. A perfect place for her to die, people said later. Surrounded by books, in the place she loved most. All these months later, I can't figure out if I feel guilty for being in the secret cupboard when it happened, or glad. I spend most of the afternoon in the secret cupboard with Alfie. He is very happy. I set up some newspaper in his water bowl, and he remains there cheerfully even during the short periods when I have to dart out and be seen by Carmel on the floor. I am doing one such trip when Gail spots me.
"Fern, there you are. There was a man here to see you earlier, but I couldn't find you."
"A man? This is most peculiar. Wally?" She shakes her head.
"No, a different man."
I frown. I don't know many men, and apart from Wally, I don't know any who would pop in randomly to see me at the library. "Well, what did he look like?" Gail thinks about it.
"Good looking. 30s, probably. Clean shaven and nicely dressed."
I'm stumped. "Are you sure he wanted to see me?"
"He asked for Fern. He said he was a friend."
I assume it must be a mistake. He probably asked to see someone else, or maybe he wanted to borrow a book on Fern's. Did he leave a message?
"No, he said he'd come back another day."
"Oh, well, then I expect he will. If he was actually looking for me." I'm distracted from the clean-shaven mystery visitor when I spot Wally walking into the library. He mustn't see me because he walks quickly past me, headed toward the shower room. "How did the meeting go?" I say, running to catch up to him. Wally keeps walking. "I can't talk right now." He pushes through the door into the vestibule, and I slow my step. I usually stay out of there in the afternoon, as it tends to get a little stinky. But today I decide I'll brave it. Wally whirls around. "Are you planning to follow me into the shower?" "No," I say. "I thought you'd stop before we got there." "And you did." I grin. "How did the meeting go?" "The meeting didn't happen, okay?" I frown. "Why didn't the meeting happen?" "I was going to take the train to the city, but I couldn't find an all-day parking spot at the station. The most I could find was 2 hours, so I didn't go." I stare at him.
"Because you couldn't find anywhere to park?"
He rolls his eyes. "You have no idea how difficult it is to find adequate parking." "I wouldn't say I have no idea. Such a thing as moving a car around is actually very easy to imagine." "Are you trying to be funny?" "No," I say. "Was that funny?" I am genuinely curious, but he doesn't respond. "Why didn't you just pay for parking?" I ask. "I didn't have any money." "I thought you did have money. You're not homeless, right?" He's red in the face now. "I didn't have any coins." He makes a noise like ugh and clenches his fist into a ball like he is angry. "Why are you angry, Wally?" "I'm angry that I missed the interview, okay? I'm angry that you're following me when I want to be alone. I'm angry because you keep calling me Wally." He's the most upset I've seen him. I think of something Janet said to me once when a borrower had been very angry that a book they had reserved hadn't been returned yet. The borrower said she had walked a long way in the heat to get to the library, and she wasn't leaving without the book. She had become quite aggressive indeed. Janet had apologized profusely and offered to personally drop off the book to the woman when it was returned. Then Janet had asked if there was anything else she could help her with. That was the moment the woman broke down in tears and confessed that it was the anniversary of her son's death and she'd been desperate to escape the day by losing herself in a good book. Janet had driven the woman home via the bookstore, where she'd purchased for the woman not only the one she'd reserved, but also several others. "Why were you so kind to her?" I asked when Janet returned to the library. "When she'd been so rude to you." "Angry is just a pen name for sad," Janet had explained. "In my experience, 9 times out of 10, if you are kind to the angry person, you will calm them down and find out what is really going on with them." "You know," I say to Wally, "I have a parking spot at my place. I'm a 5-minute walk from the train station. You're welcome to park there if you have another meeting. Or any time, really." He frowns, his expression different again. Not angry, more confused.
"That's very generous."
"Not really. I don't own a car, so it just sits there empty." He appears to think about this for a moment. "I do have one thing to ask in exchange, though." Wally crosses his arms.
"Oh? What?"
He watches me through narrowed eyes. His eyelashes are long and dark and curled, like an old-fashioned doll's. "I'd be most grateful," I say, "if I could keep calling you Wally." To my surprise, Wally throws back his head and laughs. And even though I'm not sure why we're laughing, I laugh too. I arrive at the bowling alley at approximately 6:30 on Wednesday evening. I'm unable to confirm the exact timing due to leaving my phone at home. This oversight is unlike me, and I attribute it to the low-level anxiety I've felt all day at the prospect of visiting a bowling alley. A bowling alley, with its noise and lights and smells, is most definitely out of my comfort zone. Part of me, the rebellious part, feels excited about this. The rest of me is struggling to breathe. I caught the bus here. Wally had offered to drive me, but small talk in cars always gives me a headache, so the bus seemed a safer option. The flyer in the staff room said it was a 6:45 p.m. meetup for a 7:00 p.m. start, which would allow everyone time to select their bowling footwear and to collect their meal coupons and tokens for the pinball machines. Learning about the pinball machines had been a blow. Games tended to be loud and bright, and I hate loud, bright places. But I've prepared for it as best I can, and I find myself feeling cautiously optimistic. I feel pleased to see that I've beat Wally here, even if he arrives just a few minutes after me, at 6:33 p.m., jogging up the ramp, hat bobbing on his head. He's in such a hurry he almost runs past me. "Wally," I say, as he's about to jog through the entrance. He slows to a stop and smiles tentatively, his gaze close to my face. Then he begins to speak. "I'm wearing earplugs," I say, "so I can't hear you." Wally blinks, then his mouth moves again. "I said I can't hear you," I say louder. He pushes his glasses up on his nose and then gestures for me to remove an earplug. Reluctantly, I do.
"I just inquired as to why you are wearing those," he says, pointing to my eyes.
"The swimming goggles? I find they work better than sunglasses to block out the garish lights at these kinds of places." The barest of smiles appears at Wally's lips.
"I see."
I am aware, of course, that the goggles are a fashion faux pas, but I'd hoped that people might just go with it and assume there was some sort of new trend.
"Listen," Wally says, "while your earplug is out, I wanted to say that I'm sorry for being rude the other day. I hadn't been to this sort of meeting in a while. And you were right, it wasn't about not being able to find a parking spot. I shouldn't have got snappy with you."
"You were right." These words remain lodged in my head. You were right. And not just about anything, about something in the muddy, confusing world of feelings. I can't wait to tell Rose.
"Are you feeling better now?" I inquire.
He nods.
"As a matter of fact, I rescheduled my meeting for tomorrow afternoon."
I give a little clap that feels quite jaunty, and I make up my mind to try it again tonight.
"Fantastic news! And you'll park at my place?"
"If you don't mind."
"I don't mind," I say, replacing my earplug. Wally opens his mouth again, but when I point to my earplug, he closes it again, and we venture inside. My senses are assaulted the moment the doors open.
even with the goggles and earplugs. The inside of the bowling alley smells like popcorn and hot dogs and cotton candy, a smell that coats my skin and clogs my pores and fills me up from bottom to top like sand inside my skin. My sneakers stick to the patterned carpet as I walk. The flashing neon lights burn into my retinas. The music blares from all directions, the game machines, the bowling lanes, the overhead speakers. And while the earplugs dull this slightly, it's still overwhelming. I keep my head down and forge through it, wading further into the wild. Along one wall, about a dozen kids crowd around a long metal table singing happy birthday to a boy who, according to the numeral on his cake, is 11 years old. Everyone coexists in the space, entirely unperturbed by all of it. Everyone, apparently, except me. On the back wall, I locate a sign that reads Bayside Library Team Building and usher Wally toward it. Carmel is standing there, wearing a red shirt and a short scarf tied at her throat. Strange as it sounds, she looks rather nice. "You're wearing a scarf," I say to Carmel. She studies me curiously, then says something I can't hear. I turn away from her, looking instead at a group of youths standing around a vending machine dispensing Pokemon cards. Their appearance suggests they are around 10 or 11. Rose and I went bowling when we were a similar age. I was apprehensive about it, but when Rose suggested to Mum we stay home, she just became more determined to take us. "It will be great fun," she'd said, before she and Rose got into an impassioned argument that only made things worse. Eventually, it was clear that we would have to bowl. When we got there, my strategy was to remain focused on the bowling. I'd read a book about bowling technique, and I got 3 strikes that night. It might have been fun if not for the back and forth between Mum and Rose the whole time. "The food is cold. My shoes don't fit. It's not your turn." And then, as we waited in line to hand back the shoes, "You ruined the evening. This is why we can't ever go out. What is wrong with you?" Rose cried all the way home. I look back at Carmel, who is talking animatedly to Wally, frowning and smiling and nodding at intervals. I haven't seen Carmel smile much before. I notice she has a silver tooth close to the back. As they talk, Wally rummages through a tub of bowling shoes. He catches my eye and mouths, "Foot size?" 7, I reply, and the next thing I know, I am sitting on a bench while Wally fits me with bowling shoes. It's bizarre having someone put your shoes on as if you're a child or a mannequin. I tell Wally it's unnecessary, but he keeps doing it, so I let him. It's actually rather nice. By 6:45 p.m, the whole team has arrived, and Carmel gathers the group to deliver some sort of welcome that I can't hear. Then we are divided into teams, and Wally and I are placed with Gail and Linda, who are delighted by Wally's presence, judging by the amount of unnecessary touching of his shoulder, forearm, and hand. Wally was correct when he said he was quite good at bowling. In fact, it's fair to say that he is an exceptional bowler. He gets 3 strikes in the first 3 bowls, and I get 2. Gail and Linda don't hit a pin between them. Carmel, I notice, doesn't bowl at all. Instead, using the time to wander up and down among the 3 teams, much like she does at the library with her cart. At the end of the round, Wally waves his hands in front of my face. I watch his mouth carefully. "May I get you a drink?" he says slowly. I am thirsty, I realize. I glance over at the bar area, past a horde of squealing children, to see what they might have available. Behind the bar, which is staffed by a woman in a pink and white striped boiler suit, I see a sign that says Sprite. "A Sprite would be very nice, thank you, Wally." Wally nods and wanders off toward the bar, leaving me to ponder how nice it is having someone inquire after my thirst like this and then procure me a drink. Wally is, I realize, an above-average date. Linda and Gail appear to think the same, judging by the way they appear in front of me the moment Wally is out of sight. "I can't hear you," I remind them. They gesture for me to remove my earplugs. I sigh loudly, but acquiesce.
"You've been keeping this quiet, haven't you?" Linda exclaims.
"They met in the library," Gail quips.
"I like his hat," Linda says. "It reminds me of something."
"I know what you mean," Gail says. I don't know why they required me to remove my earplugs, since they are only speaking among themselves. I glance around for Wally to see how he is doing with our drinks, but he seems to have disappeared. Where's Wally? I ask.
Of course, Gail and Linda cry in unison. Where's Wally? That's who he looks like.
Noises ricochet around the room. Someone cheers and a child cries and a bowling ball hits the polished lane. I wrap my arms around my middle.
Finished here, ladies, Carmel says.
Just taking a break while Rocco gets us some drinks, Gail says.
I see him now, leaning over the bar, making his order. He glances back at me, and for an instant our eyes meet.
Remind me again how you met him, Fern, Carmel says.
I open my mouth just as a game machine starts playing a tune, and the sound of collective victory and defeat from a couple of small boys rings in my ears.
She met him at the library, Gail says. Right, Fern?
Nearby, the token machine releases a stack of tokens. Clink, 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 clink. I feel people moving closer to me, making space for a person in a wheelchair who is being wheeled past.
What?
You met Rocco in the library,
Gail repeats louder. Carmel and Linda keep asking me questions, even as the noise continues around me. It's like a ride I can't get off. I put my earplugs back in, close my eyes, and start to rock gently, then more vigorously.
Fern, someone says. They must be speaking loud because I can hear them through my earplugs.
I open my eyes again. They're all looking at me, glancing at each other worriedly, then looking back at me. Wally is nowhere to be found.
What?
I say, but I must say it too loud or too quiet or in a strange voice because they all appear rattled. I rock harder. Disco music plays loudly enough for me to clearly make out the tune even with my earplugs in. Several people dance while they wait for their turn to bowl. My breath is high in my chest, and my head is aching.
Drinks!
Wally appears, smiling, carrying a tray of drinks. I feel like I might scream. Perhaps I do scream, because all of a sudden everyone is gathered around me. It's unbearable.
Move!
I shout, and they all take a few steps back. Wally places a hand on my wrist, but I rip it away. He nods, then says, Fern, follow me. He waits for a moment to make sure he has my attention, then begins to walk. I follow him, a few paces back, through the gap he has created in the crowd, through the building and out the automatic doors into the cool, soothing air, then away from the entrance and out into the parking lot.
Are you all right?
Wally asks, once we are away from the noise and the smells and the lights. My heart is still thundering. I thought I could do it, I say to Wally, or myself.
I thought it would be okay.
Wally nods.
One thing I've learned about facing fear, he says, is that sometimes it's just too scary.
Journal of Rose Ingrid Castle. Yesterday, Owen and I took the Eurostar to Paris. It was late when we checked into our hotel room on the Champs-Élysées, and when I woke this morning, Owen was at my bedside with strawberries and proper French coffee. Today, we spent the day strolling around the streets, eating and drinking and window shopping. There was a particularly sweet moment while we were climbing the stairs to the Sacré-Cœur in Montmartre. A little girl in a red coat had tripped up the stairs, and Owen had scooped her up before she even hit the ground and popped her back on her feet. It had made me smile and ache all at once. That could be our little girl, I thought. If only I could give him a child. I tried to put it out of my mind, and I did manage to for a while. But then another thought started to distract me. Fern. She hadn't been answering my calls. She didn't even answer when we agreed on a scheduled time. It was so unlike her. I know she is probably fine, but what if she isn't? That's the tough part. If she were a child, I could call the cops and ask them to go over there and they would. But Fern isn't a child. For heaven's sake, I'm the one always advocating for her to be treated equally as an adult. But in the real world, she's not like other adults. And she's my sister. And if I don't protect her, who will? My therapist says I'm a perfectionist in all things, including sisterhood. That is true enough. Ever since I was a child, I've longed to be perfect. If I could just be perfect, I used to think, everything would be okay. It became my life's mission. Each night I would lie in bed and plan the perfect day, a day incapable of upsetting Mum. I'd get up early, make my own breakfast, clear the dishes quietly. I'd keep an eye out for things I could do to be helpful. Put on a load of laundry, sort the socks, bring Mum a cup of coffee. Mum loved it when I did things like that. She'd smile and say, "You're a good girl, Rose." But no matter how hard I tried, I always got something wrong. If I put on the laundry before school, by the time I got home it had sat there for too long and needed to be rewashed. If I made dinner, I accidentally used ingredients Mum had bought for another meal. If I tidied up, I'd always lose something important that Mum had left out intentionally. It didn't take long before Mum's voice permanently took up residence in my mind. It was clear that something was very wrong with me. I was stupid, lazy, selfish. I didn't pay enough attention to things. I didn't look after my sister properly. I was bad. Sometimes I was bad, even when I hadn't done anything. Before I was diagnosed a diabetic, even my health was a source of great irritation to Mum. I knew better than to complain about feeling thirsty or lightheaded, but there were things I couldn't avoid. For example, occasionally I wet the bed, a classic symptom of juvenile diabetes, I found out later, but at the time we didn't know that. "You wet the bed again, Rose? Again? What is the matter with you?" I begged Mum to take me to the doctor for months before we finally went. And even after I was diagnosed, Mum still acted like I was making a big deal out of nothing. Every time I tested my blood sugar, she'd roll her eyes. Fern, on the other hand, read up eagerly on diabetes and became an expert, often pointing out what I could and couldn't eat to Mum. It made Mum wild. There was something about us sticking up for each other that set her off. Like the time we were 10, Fern and I had just got in from school and we were sitting side by side at the kitchen table with our homework books open. Mum usually napped at this time of day, so we'd both been startled when we heard her pottering around. After a few minutes, she came into the kitchen. Immediately, I knew something bad was coming. Her eyes looked strange. They always looked strange when something bad was coming. "All right," she said. "I know what you've done. If you come clean and admit it, you won't be punished. But if you don't admit it, there will be consequences for you both." Fern looked at me with a puzzled, questioning look in her eyes. I tapped my bracelet against hers and tried to choose my words carefully.
"What is it, Mum?"
"Don't insult my intelligence, young lady. You know exactly what I'm talking about. Look at that face, all innocent. You think I don't know what a conniving little bitch you are?" I ran through a list in my head. Had I unknowingly shrunk a piece of her clothing in the dryer? Eaten something she'd earmarked for herself? Been too loud? Too happy? Too miserable? One option was to pick one of those things, but if I was wrong, then I'd be in trouble for two things. I thought until my head hurt. When I couldn't come up with a response, I couldn't help it. I cried. "Here come the waterworks," Mum said, rolling her eyes. "It's not going to work this time, Rose. We're not leaving this room until one of you admit it." I knew Mum meant it. Once she had locked us outside for hours until we confessed to another crime, stealing her jewelry that time, which she later found behind her dresser. It was the peak of summer and we didn't have sunscreen on, so we'd huddled under the one tree in the communal yard, following the shade as it moved. I remember watching some other kids from the building squealing as they ran through the garden sprinkler. We didn't dare ask to join them, so instead, to pass the time, Fern recounted the plot of the Agatha Christie she'd been reading to me. She was quite good at that, the storytelling. Mum didn't let us inside until after dark, when the mosquitoes had feasted on us and we'd scratched our ankles so hard we were bleeding. "Right," Mum had said this day. "Well, I'll just have to pick one of you to be punished. Eeny, meeny, miny, mo." She pointed at Fern. "It was me," I said immediately. Fern looked surprised, but Mum didn't. As usual, Mum knew exactly what she was doing. She knew I'd never let Fern get in trouble. "I'm sorry," I said. "Go to your room and don't come out until I tell you,"
Mum slurred. After an hour or two, the doorbell rang. Pizza delivery. We'd never had pizza delivered before. It smelled amazing. Mum didn't call me for dinner, nor did I expect her to. But I was surprised when Fern hadn't come to bed by 8 p.m. I'd been in my room for hours by then, without food and with only half a glass of water that had been sitting beside my bed. I'd been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes a few months earlier, and I knew if I didn't eat, my blood sugar would become dangerously low. I searched the room for food, the pockets of my clothing and Fern's. There was nothing. Still, Mum didn't come. I waited and waited. By midnight, I had a headache. By morning, I was shaky, drenched in sweat, and I felt like a sledgehammer was thumping at my temples. The half glass of water was gone. I was freezing, which I knew meant I was hypoglycemic. I needed sugar. Juice, preferably. I needed to test for ketones. I needed to eat. Around 9 a.m., when the door flew open, I didn't even have the energy to lift my head. Mum was standing in the doorway. In her hand was a glass of orange juice. She watched me for a long time. I remember thinking, she's worried. She's realized how sick I am. She'll be horrified by the state of me and she'll rush to my bedside. She might even drive me to the doctor. Instead, she calmly sat on the bed. But instead of offering me the juice, she placed it on the bedside table just out of my reach and then held out a wad of cash. Tens, twenties, even fifties. You lied, she said quietly, holding it out to me. You didn't take the money. I just found it in my dresser drawer. At first I was confused. I'd almost forgotten the reason I was in here. So that was it. She thought I'd stolen her money. The idea, of course, was laughable. Of course I didn't take her money. But she already knew that. She'd merely fabricated it to create some drama. Sometimes I don't know what is wrong with you, Rose. Why didn't you just tell me you didn't do it? You could have saved everyone a lot of trouble. I'm sorry, I said, or at least tried to, but my throat was too dry to project it. Mum considered this a moment, a long moment. I glanced at the juice. Well, Mum said after an eternity, I'll forgive you this time, but don't lie to me again, all right? I nodded. Good. She smiled. In that case, all is forgiven. Mum held out her arms for a hug, indicating I should hoist myself upright. This, I think, was Mum's favourite part, the forgiving. It made her feel like a good mother, an honourable, noble mother. Her eyes shone with goodness. But the whole time she held me, all I could think of was how much longer I would have to wait before I could ask my honourable mother for that glass of juice. Fern. Wally drives me home. I'm not used to being in a vehicle at night. It's dark outside and the noises are sharper, more delineated. The click of the car's indicator while we wait at the traffic lights, the sound of the steering wheel moving under Wally's hands, it's almost hypnotic. By the time Wally pulls up in front of my house, I'm practically in a trance. How are you doing? He asks when I don't get out of the car. Not great, I say. Pretty embarrassed. Embarrassed? Wally pulls up the handbrake. It's loud in the quiet car. His gaze settles over my shoulder, as usual. Fern, can I tell you something? I nod. Before I lived in this van, I developed an app called Shout with a friend of mine. It allowed people to order food and drinks from their table without having to go to the bar, and it allowed restaurants not to have to employ waiters to take orders, only to ferry food back and forth from the kitchen. There are several apps like it now, but it was the first of its kind. I was the programmer. I designed it, coded it, tested it, and it was a huge success. Congratulations. Thanks. It was pretty exciting at first, but then I had to start doing other stuff apart from coding. I had to go to marketing meetings. I had to network with investors, that kind of thing. My partner kept saying things like, This is the most important meeting of our careers. We'd go to cocktail parties and have to talk to people, not even about shout. We'd just talk about sports or horse racing or whatever the other person found interesting. I didn't understand what I was doing there, and I hated it. Wally glances at me briefly, then back over my shoulder. The pressure was enormous. It wore away at me. I stopped going into work. I stopped getting out of bed. I think my partner would have ditched me, but we were so close to selling. Then we did sell it, and we got this ridiculous amount of money, and everyone was ecstatic, and I just fell apart. The night after we sold, when everyone else was celebrating, I was in the emergency room with chest pains. I thought I was having a heart attack. I was referred to a psychiatrist and kept as an inpatient at a mental facility for nearly a month. A full-blown nervous breakdown, apparently. I was so ashamed that when I got out, I left my big successful life behind and moved to Australia. Why? He shrugs. You can't get much farther away than Australia, can you? And I had a passport because of my mom. I thought over here I'd get another chance to just be me. One of the reasons I got the van was because I needed to make my life small. Wally shakes his head. But over the last few months, I've been developing another app. That's what my meeting is about tomorrow. Some investors are interested. My point is that lots of people get in over their heads. It doesn't mean you can't try again. Are you suggesting I try bowling again? He thinks about this. Or not. But don't let it scare you off trying things. Wally looks away from me at the windscreen. His arms loosely grip the steering wheel, and I fixate on the dark brown hairs on his arms, his slender wrists, his long, elegant fingers. Was it the touch? He asks. I wonder if I missed a critical part of the conversation. Pardon? At the bowling alley. I touched your arm, before you screamed. Was that what upset you? Oh, no. Well, it wasn't just the touch. It was the lights, the music, the smells, the staring, and the touch. I'm sorry, he says. It's all right. I should have known. You should have known that I don't like to be touched? Why would you know that? Because, he says, I don't like to be touched either. I've learned to do it, to shake hands, to hug, to pat someone on the back, because that's what people do. But I don't like it. But just because you don't like it doesn't mean that I won't like it. True, he says. But you are a little bit like me. I open my mouth in surprise. Alike? I want to cry, what ways are we alike? But then, it hits me. The way that Wally looks over my shoulder. His commitment to being punctual. His failing to attend his interview and his frustration at himself afterward. He doesn't like to be touched. Wally is indeed a little bit like me. How had I not noticed this? The idea of this brings on a flood of comfort and security, like I'm being seen and understood. I feel like a foreigner in a new country who, after months of not being understood, has finally run into someone who speaks my language. You don't like to be touched? I ask. Not at all. Some touching is okay. Wally says. If I'm expecting it, it's not so bad. And a firm touch is better than a light one. Light touches are the worst, I exclaim. Light surprise touches. I'm okay with my loved ones touching me, Wally says. Though usually they know how to do it right. Or not do it at all, I agree. What about sex? Good or bad? Wally thinks about this for a minute. Good and bad. Depending on many factors. I don't really know what the fuss is about, I admit. It seems a bizarre thing to do if you think about it. How did people even discover it? Wally rests his head against the headrest and frowns. It's a good question. I guess Adam and Eve must have got bored in the Garden of Eden from time to time. Maybe it was a dare? Or maybe Eve tripped and fell and, I don't know, landed on Adam? Wally's cheeks are extraordinarily red, I notice. It makes me laugh a little. And after a second, Wally does too. It's magic. People rarely laugh at the same things that I do.
Usually when I laugh, other people are silent, and when others laugh, I'm still trying to understand the joke. Before long, we are both laughing so hard that tears appear in the corners of my eyes, and I have to wipe them away. Wally wipes tears away too. He steals a sideways glance at me, and we lock in a rare moment of direct eye contact. It's funny what happens then. It's as though there's a change in the atmosphere or something. I have to concentrate on taking a breath, which makes me aware how loud I am breathing. "Would you like to have sex with me?" I ask. Wally freezes. It is, admittedly, a sizable deviation from my plan. For one thing, there are at least 2 days until I ovulate. For another, at least according to the romance novels I've read, when it comes to seducing men, there tends to be very little in the way of ascertaining of the other party's interest. If the novels are anything to go by, sex is supposed to kick off with the hero crushing his lips against mine after doing something to upset me. So, I watch Wally's reaction with interest. His eyes widen slightly and his lips part, but he doesn't speak for some time. I am pleased with this reaction. I suspect I would have felt a little startled by the crushing lips. As he contemplates my request, I settle back into the cozy pod of the van with the darkness surrounding us. I am feeling something approaching relaxed, until a sudden pounding on Wally's window sends us both flying off our seats.
"Do you have permission to have your van parked here? This is private property, you know."
I recognize the voice as that belonging to my neighbor, Mrs. Hazelbury. Through Wally's window, I see that she's dressed in her peach candlewick robe, holding it together with both hands at the throat. I can't see from where I'm sitting, but I'd hazard a guess she's also wearing her matching slippers. Wally rolls down his window and she peers into the van.
"Fern," Mrs. Hazelbury says. "There you are. I've been trying to get in touch with you all night."
This is a surprise. Mrs. Hazelbury never tries to get in touch with me. She prefers to wait at her window and call out as I walk by on my way to work. "Have you seen my newspaper? It has gone missing 2 days in a row. Do you know what is happening to the block of land down the road that has been purchased by developers? Do you think the new people in flat number 5 have got guests staying?"
"Your sister called twice,"
Mrs. Hazelbury says, craning her neck to see farther into the van.
"Apparently she's been calling your mobile phone all night and there's been no answer."
I feel a shiver down my spine, a sluice of ice water. Rose has called? Again? What have I done now?
"She wanted me to peek in your window and make sure you weren't lying dead on the floor," Mrs. Hazelbury says. "I have to say I did notice a small dog in there while I was looking, which I'm certain is against the rules of the body corporate."
"I left my phone at home," I say to no one.
"There was a man hanging around earlier too," Mrs. Hazelbury continues, taking a closer look at Wally. "It wasn't you, was it?"
"No. He was bigger and his hair was lighter."
In the back of my mind, I think of the mystery man who visited me at the library. The same guy? Perhaps I've forgotten to pay a bill and they are sending someone door to door, but I put that thought aside for the moment.
"What did Rose want?"
Mrs. Hazelbury throws up her hands.
"How should I know? Perhaps you should go and call her back instead of idling in this car all evening, keeping everyone awake."
After finishing her inspection of Wally's van, she gives us a nod and wanders off. I reach for the door handle. "I'd better go," I say. "Sounds like Rose is worried." Wally frowns, gazing just over my shoulder again. "Just because she called doesn't mean you've done something wrong, Fern." I feel the tingle again, low-level dread, this time in the pit of my stomach. "Unfortunately, in my case, it does."
"She's very involved in your life, isn't she? It feels like she calls every time we're together."
"Rose is protective. She's looked after me all my life, so she knows the situations I find myself in. If it wasn't for her, who knows where I'd be? Last time she called, she saved Alfie's life, remember?" Wally doesn't respond. "Anyway," I say, "I'd better go call her." I slide out of the car and slam the door. Wally waits until I've made it up the stairs and am safely inside. It's funny to think that only a moment ago I was asking Wally to have sex with me. Goes to show, it really does just take a moment for everything to change. I have 17 missed calls, all of them from Rose. There is also a text message. Call me ASAP. I run through a mental list in my head. What could I have done? Alfie is lying contently on the couch. The oven is off. Mrs. Hazelbury didn't report anything out of the ordinary. What else could it be? I am still running through possibilities when my phone rings again. Rose.
Fern, thank God I've been so worried.
Why have you been worried?
Because I told you I was going to call tonight at 7 p.m. I wanted to see how Alfie was. I called and called and you didn't respond.
I wait. That's it?
That's it. Fern, you could have been lying dead in a ditch for all I know.
What would I be doing in a ditch?
Fern,
she exhales exasperatedly. I don't remember you saying you were going to call, I say. What time is it over there?
It's 2 hours after we were supposed to talk, she says. When you didn't answer, I had to go through my emails to find Mrs. Hazelbury's number, and then I asked her to look through your window and check that you weren't dead.
I know. She told me.
I was really worried, Fern.
Rose sounds agitated. I, on the other hand, am flooded with relief. I missed a call. Not ideal for a worrier like Rose, but no one has been harmed. No one has died. Everything is fine.
Where were you? Rose asks.
After everything that's happened, it takes me a moment to remember. At the team building night, we went bowling. There's a short silence. This is exactly why I hate phone calls. A silence can mean so many things. Has the call dropped out? Is she taking a sip of her drink? Is she waiting for me to say something? Finally, she speaks.
You went bowling?
Yes.
Why? Is this because of the new boss?
Rose knows how much I loved Janet. Yes, it was compulsory for all staff to attend. It didn't go well, I admit. I hear her exhale.
Oh, Fern, did you get overwhelmed?
A little, I say, deciding not to tell her about the sensory meltdown. Rose worries too much as it is.
You must be tired, she says. How did you get home?
A friend drove me. Another pause.
Which friend?
Wally. The longest pause yet.
Is Wally a guy?
There's something about Rose's tone that irritates me. Of course, she could never just be happy that I have a guy friend. I also feel irritated at myself. Why do I need her to be happy? That's the strangest thing about having a sister, in my opinion. The way you can be mad at them and want their approval all at once. Yes, he's a guy.
Where did you meet him?
At the library. He was taking a shower.
A shower?
Rose sounds mad. He doesn't have a shower, I explain. He lives in his van. I glance out the window and am pleasantly surprised to see the van is still out there. I squint at the driver's seat, trying to spot him. The van is in darkness, but it's possible that he's in the back. Maybe he's already gone to sleep? I kneel on my couch to get a better view.
So, let me get this straight. You've been bowling tonight, and you were driven home by a man who lives in his van?
From my kneeling spot on the couch, I replay the sentence in my head and find it accurate. Yes.
Fern, you need to be careful. This man could be trying to take advantage of you. For money or food or even sex.
I smile at the last part. If only she knew. There is a knock on the door. I startle and fall off the couch onto the floorboards.
Fern, are you all right?
Fine, I say, straightening up. Rose, I've got to go. Someone is at the door.
At this time of night?
I end the call and get to my feet. Almost immediately, the phone starts to ring again, but I ignore it, flinging open the door. It's Wally. I didn't answer your question, he says. What question? Wally's cheeks turn crimson.
Well, we were talking about Adam and Eve, and you said...
He drifts off. I wait. Wally rubs the bridge of his nose under his glasses.
I said...
Wally lets go of his nose and steps into my flat, grinning.
Are you really going to make me say it?
Say what? He shakes his head.
You are funny.
I'm not sure why I'm funny, but as he sweeps me into his arms and presses his lips to mine, it seems moot, as I couldn't have answered him anyway. Sex with Wally is a pleasant surprise. The few times I'd had sex with Albert, it had been with duty, even with curiosity, but each time he crawled his way around my body, I could barely think of anything else but the moment it would be over. With Wally, I find myself having a lot of thoughts. Thoughts of, maybe we could try this next, or what is it that you are doing there and why does it feel so good? And how can I arrange for us to do this all the time? The fact that I was trying to get pregnant escaped my mind entirely until the moment it was over. When I do remember, I can't find it within myself to care.
Is it safe?
He'd asked, when we were both naked and he was hovering over me. An odd question, I thought, but then I supposed it was important that one felt safe when they were in a new environment. I'd taken a few moments to ponder this, finally determining that while it wasn't impossible that a madman could burst into my flat at any given moment wielding a handgun, neither was my flat war-torn Syria. So, after an appropriate amount of consideration, I'd replied, "Yes, it's safe." And that seemed to be the right answer, because everything commenced rather quickly after that. Afterward, I couldn't stop giggling. When Wally asked me why, I couldn't explain it. A physical reaction, I decided, was the only explanation. I think I had an orgasm, I said. I mean, I'm not sure. How do you know, do you think? Wally rolled over so he was lying on his side.
Actually, I'm not sure, he said thoughtfully. Shall we Google it?
Good idea. And so we lay there, in bed, Googling orgasms and clicking on articles. After reading 8 or 9 articles, we determined that it was very likely that I'd had one, but it would be better to try again so we could be totally sure. Wally leaves before morning, which makes me like him even more. As much as I'd savored the night with him, I am keen to keep my morning routine intact. There's been enough disruption this week, I decide, but as I go through my yoga poses, I find I'm still thinking about him. I imagine telling Rose about my relationship with Wally. Wouldn't that be something? On television and in books, sisters always talk to each other about these kinds of things, teasing each other about boys, confiding secrets. I imagine Rose gasping and giggling and demanding sordid details. I imagine her helping me get ready for a date and begging for details afterward. It would be something I'd quite enjoy, I decide. I'd hoped for this sort of reaction when I started dating Albert. I have a boyfriend, I'd told her, even though Albert and I hadn't specifically used the terms boyfriend and girlfriend. Still, I'd come to recognize our behaviors as typical of those in that kind of relationship, so it seemed a logical conclusion to draw. His name is Albert.
What do you mean, you have a boyfriend?
This should have been my first warning. Unlike the vast majority of the population, Rose didn't usually ask questions to which she already knew the answer. She knew I didn't understand it when people did this, but this day she seemed to have forgotten. I mean, I have a boyfriend, I replied. Rose didn't gasp or giggle, but she did ask dozens of questions about Albert, none of them in the least bit interesting. What was his last name? Where did he live? What was he studying? Her lip curled as she talked, as if her boyfriend was something that personally offended her. When can I meet him? Had been the last question, something of a surprise given that she'd seemed so disgusted by his existence. After some prodding, I'd agreed to bring Albert to dinner at her place, where she'd proceeded to ask him all the same questions she'd asked me, and more. There was no nudging or winking or giggling. There was nothing fun about it at all. There was nothing fun about it the next day either, when Albert stopped talking to me. So I decided it might be better not to tell Rose about Wally. For now. At 9:15 a.m., when I'm about to leave for work, Mrs. Hazelbury knocks on my door.
I'm sorry to bother you so early, Fern, but I wanted to catch you before you went to work. I have a copy of the body corporate documentation here.
She holds up a stack of papers and places her eyeglasses on her nose.
Section 4.2 states that no dogs are permitted in the building, and section 15.6 states, and I quote, parking of larger vehicles, including trucks, trailers, and caravans, is strictly not permitted by building bylaws.
She removes her glasses and looks at me expectantly.
Are you familiar with these bylaws?
I am, I say. In fact, I'd read the body corporate documents very carefully after moving Alfie into my flat and then done subsequent research on the computers when the library was quiet. However, bylaws that have a blanket ban on pets have been found to be contrary to Section 180 of the Domestic Animals Act, which advises that a bylaw must not be oppressive or unreasonable, having regard to the interest of all owners and occupiers of lots included in the scheme and the use of common property for the scheme.
Mrs. Hazelbury blinks. I take her blank expression to mean she needs further explanation.
That means the bylaw can say what it wants, but owners' corporations do not have the legal power to prohibit pets from private properties.
Now Mrs. Hazelbury understands. I can tell because she becomes red in the face.
As for the van, I continue, you'll find it is not a caravan or trailer. It is registered as a standard motor vehicle and as such does not breach any of the bylaws mentioned. Anyway, I do need to get going now, Mrs. Hazelbury, or I'll be late for work.
With that, I take Alfie by his lead, walk out, and close the door behind us, leaving Mrs. Hazelbury standing speechless at my front door. Everyone is especially kind to me at the library today, and I ascertain it is because of the scene I made at the bowling alley last night. It is also possible it is because there is a dog by my side. With Wally at his meeting today, I had no alternative but to bring Alfie to the library with me. The fact that Carmel is at an interlibrary meeting for the morning is a fortuitous twist of fate, and one I take advantage of. Alfie is a big hit with library staff and borrowers alike. Even the grumpy old folks who've been bussed in from the nursing home cheer a little at the sight of him. Linda uses him as a prop during story hour. Gail goes out to buy dog treats on her break, and feeds him so many that he can't do much more than loll about at my feet while I process returned books into the system. Of course, he chooses the second that Carmel has arrived back from her meeting to poop on the carpet.
"What on earth is going on here?"
she cries, as I'm on my hands and knees with a spray bottle and paper towel. I look up. Carmel is wearing those eyeglasses that become sunglasses when you go outside. Except she's inside and the glasses don't seem to have realized.
"Oh, Fern," she says, softer now.
"Hello. It's good to see that you're feeling better after last night." She trails off. I get the feeling I'm supposed to say something. I'm starting to get the hang of the strange way Carmel talks, but I'm not sure what. Eventually I try, and it does the trick, bizarrely.
"Anyway, as I told you the other day, dogs are not allowed in the library."
"Actually," I say, "owners of assistance dogs have the right to take their animals into all public places and onto public transport, including buses and trains. The Commonwealth Disability Discrimination Act of 1992 makes it unlawful to discriminate against a person with a disability who is using an assistance..."
Carmel frowns underneath her rapidly fading glasses.
"So, you're saying this is an assistance dog?"
I look at Alfie dubiously.
"Yes?" "I see. Then I assume you know it is a requirement that assistance dog owners must provide evidence of their disability when requested."
I don't reply, but Carmel waits, so I throw in another,
"So?"
Carmel says expectantly.
"Where is your evidence of disability?"
I've underestimated Carmel. I've also underestimated her glasses, because in this short time, they've almost returned to clear. I cross my arms.
"Fern, the dog has got to go."
I frown, looking off into the distance. "Sorry, will you excuse me, Carmel? I think I hear someone calling." I rise to my feet and am about to walk off when Carmel says,
"Please don't walk away while I'm talking to you, Fern."
"But you'd finished talking. You said the dog had to go, and then I walked away."
"But..."
Carmel looks utterly discombobulated. You hadn't answered me.
I place a hand to my brow and close my eyes, breathing deeply, the way women in old-fashioned movies did before they took to their beds. I've always wanted to try it, and it is surprisingly gratifying.
You didn't ask a question, Carmel. How am I supposed to answer a question if one hasn't been posed?
Carmel doesn't reply, even though that was a question. Like me, she is also breathing deeply. I think she too would like to take to her bed.
Fern, will you please make alternative arrangements for the dog? She asks after a long silence.
I sigh. At least she has been clear, I suppose. I pull my phone from my pocket to check the time. Wally will have finished his meeting by now. I thumb him a text. Satisfyingly, he writes back almost immediately. On my way.
Someone is coming to get him now, I say to Carmel.
Good, she replies, looking happier.
I trust I won't see him in the library again.
I wait until she finishes the sentence, and, not hearing a question, hurry away before she can stop me. Wally arrives at the library promptly, once again dressed in a suit and tie. The sight of him sends a bizarre, not unpleasant, zing through me.
Hello,
I call out from the back of the library, perhaps too loudly given the amount of people that turn to look at me. Alfie and I trot toward him.
Hello,
Wally says when we are closer. We have a frightening moment of eye contact before Wally bends down to pat Alfie.
How was your meeting?
It was a bigger meeting than I expected, he says. There were a bunch of people there. I gave a presentation.
Presentation, I repeat.
Wally laughs.
Sorry, presentation.
I'm enjoying the interaction so much, I decide to experiment with casual touch. I step forward and punch Wally on the arm, the way I've seen people do when they're having a laugh. But I think I do it too hard, because he stops laughing and looks alarmed.
Sorry, I say.
That's okay, he says, rubbing his arm.
So it went well? Your presentation?
Yes, he says. Very well. Maybe I can tell you about it after your shift? It's going to be a nice afternoon. Maybe we can take